when Elihu condemned Job, he condemned him because he justified himself rather than God. Job was so firm in maintaining that he was right, that there was an implication in his affirmation that if God were to find him anything else but right, then it wasn't Job that was wrong. This was his great confidence in the rightness of his ways, and this was the lengths to which his confidence took him in his arguments. And it's to this confidence of Job that both Elihu and God addressed themselves. Alfred left a gate wide open for me yesterday, but I don't propose to walk through it. For one thing, I think I should be one of the first, as one of the oldest, to walk out of the door on the question of an analysis of the speeches in Job. But what I'm going to do is to just look at a couple of verses, or at least a couple of extracts, one from Elihu, dealing with Job's self-righteousness, and one from God, dealing with the presumption of Job in this self-righteousness which he had. Let's look, shall we, first then at Job chapter 35, the one that's been read to us. Verse 6. If thou sinnest, what doest thou against him? Or if thy transgressions be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? If thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receiveth he of thine hand? Thy wickedness may hurt a man as thou art, and thy righteousness may profit the Son of Man. We can't harm God in any way at all by our evil actions, and nothing that we can do could in any way enrich him. If we fail to worship him, if we worship other gods, if we take his name in vain, if we profane his Sabbaths, he remains unmoved, unmovable, untouched, his ways and his glory completely untarnished. If we dishonor our father or our mother, it is they who are harmed and not God. And it's our days that are shortened, not his. If we kill, if we commit adultery, if we steal, if we bear false witness, if we covet, we harm our fellows, our words, our deeds, our thoughts can affect others, but they can have no effect whatever upon God himself. It isn't that God is remote or that he's inaccessible. He's everywhere. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. It's not that God's aloof or that he's unapproachable. Paul said, though he be not far from any one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. We can't escape from him. He doesn't hide himself from us. We can move quite close to him. And yet we can't mark him at all. Our sinfulness will rub off onto our fellows, but nothing that we do rubs off onto him in any way at all. It is, in fact, almost beyond belief that whereas the casual, thoughtless word can perhaps do irreparable harm to our fellows, yet a calm, deliberate, thoughtful, premeditated, harmful act can't touch God in any way, however deliberate or premeditated we may be. Nor can we enrich him. Everything that is possessed by anyone is owned by God. So that whether we acquire something, perhaps acquire it by indifferent means, or whether we lose anything, and lose it by charitable act, all we are doing is participating on our own level in some form of transfer of goods. God is the absolute and the beneficial owner of everything that there is. We turn over to the Psalms, Psalm 50, and then the psalmist speaks of this. I will, verse 9, I will take no bullock out of thine house, nor he goats out of thy folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee. For the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. And we read this, if you remember, last Thursday, when we were reading the last chapter in the first book of Chronicles, David, in his last years, making this supreme confession. Verse 10 of 1 Chronicles 29. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all. Both riches and honour come of thee, and thou reignest over all, and in thine hand is power and might, and in thine hand it is to make great, and to give strength unto all. We talk glibly about ownership, but in the strict meaning of the word, we don't own anything at all. All that we have, we merely occupy. We merely hold possession for a time. And moreover, it's a very sobering thought that the length of time of our possession is in the hand of God. You remember the parable of the rich fool? Jesus spoke to him, "This will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said unto him, "Thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. Then who shall be those things which thou hast provided?" How then can we justify ourselves for any act at all that we may carry out? There are no balances on which good deeds can be weighed, as it were, against sins. The lesson that we learn from Elihu's words to Job is that good deeds as such and sinfulness as such have no weight at all. They are completely weightless against God. Though we may feel virtuous whenever we are engaged in a charitable act, such acts, it can in no way make us righteous, can justify us. The psalmist said, "Enter not into judgment with thy servant, for in thy sight shall no man living be justified." For us now who believe in the majesty of God, Paul states the position when he writes to the Galatians. speaking of the works of the law, knowing that a man is not justified by those works, the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. Even we have believed in Jesus Christ that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. We have no justification whatever by the right of works that we do. It is God who justifies, and he justifies by faith in Jesus Christ. And then God himself turns to Job. Shall we look at Job chapter 38? God's words to him are a direct challenge to his manhood, to Job as a man. 38 verse 4. Where was thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Job had not only sought to justify himself, he'd held up himself and his righteousness alongside God, inferring in that way that God himself might be moved by the same emotions that move men to acts, even righteous acts. God's reply to Job is a direct one. Job must look at him and see him as he is. In turn, God's magnificent creative acts are paraded before Job in all their unsurpassed beauty, their majesty, and their delicate precision. All these mighty works were completed in perfection before Job was born. Before any man was born, before man was created. How can man therefore attempt to range himself alongside God? This was the burden of the message of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 5. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Drop down, ye heavens, from above, and let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the earth open, and let them bring forth salvation, and let righteousness spring up together. I, the Lord, have created it. Woe to him that striveth with his maker. A message which Paul took up, you remember, in the letter to the Romans. Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou formed me thus? This is a very deep and a very profound lesson for an age in which we live. It's Paul again, who, writing to the Romans, says in the first chapter, speaking of the creative acts of God, and speaking of this same majesty at which we're looking, verse 20, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. God can be clearly seen in his works. And really, the imagination boggles at the infinite power and wisdom which those works reveal. It's significant that as frontier after frontier of knowledge is breached, and men and all their inventions become more learned and more powerful, there has been no overhauling at all of the power and the majesty of God. It was no more easy Nor was it any more difficult for Job in a primitive age, when man was barely on the threshold of knowledge, to conceive of the majesty of God than it is for us to conceive of the majesty of God today. In this day when there's an awareness of power, when there is a physical storage of memory, as it were. No less in our day than Job in his day, can we range ourselves alongside God by way of comparison. There's just no common basis of comparison at all. God today can still challenge us with the same firm challenge that he challenged Job. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? If we are wise, we will avoid the pitfall into which Job fell and not provoke God by the challenge of the rightness of our works. It's well that we should do like David did. David, the old man, the man about to die, who thought about God, before whom he'd walked and whom he'd loved, and said in those words we've read from the first book of Chronicles, "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heaven and the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all."